Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Daniel Handler, whose latest novel is We Are Pirates. This is, I believe, the fifth novel, quote, adult novel, under Daniel Handler's name. There are over 30 books under the pseudonym Lemony Snicket. There's one book under the pseudonym of The Pope, and I'm probably missing a whole bunch of other works as well. Before we get into your career, because I want to talk about your career now that I have you in the studio, and while you are well-known, Lemony Snicket is even better well-known than you are, let's talk a little bit about the origins of your latest novel, We Are Pirates. The first thing that came to my mind is that you were looking around for an idea, and you noticed there's this island called Treasure Island in the middle of San Francisco Bay, but that might not be it.
I grew up in San Francisco, so I noticed Treasure Island probably the first time I could read. I'd actually remember that we would drive by it on the Bay Bridge when I was little, and I would see that alluring exit sign to Treasure Island, and my parents would have to explain for the umpteenth time that it contained no treasure or treasure chests of gold or anything like that. But the inspiration came not so long after it. When I was in high school, we were required to take career tests in which we were given a long, 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 exhaustive list of careers and check off the ones that sounded interesting to us. And tired of such things, I agitated my entire homeroom class. Me and my friend David convinced everyone to check other and write in the blank following other pirate. And I got interested suddenly in piracy. And I, why is everyone interested in pirates? Why would I say pirate for that prank? And for years, I thought of the idea of people in the current day trying to be pirates in the kind of classic swashbuckling mode and what it meant to want to escape from your ordinary life and to live a kind of lawless and reckless existence on the high seas. That was interesting to me.
But there's about 40 books interval between when you thought of this and today. Do pirates play any role in your other books? I mean, the Shanghaiing, people are kidnapped.
Yeah, there's some. I mean, the Snicket books have a number of dire things that happen that I guess pirates might also participate in. No, this book was in the back of my mind for a long time, just the wisp of an idea. And one day it hit me that rather than strapping young men, which I think we've seen over and over, committing acts of piracy, which I thought was kind of standard for the genre and not something I wanted to repeat, I hit upon the idea that it should be teenage girls and that then teenage girls might be interested in teaming up with members of or denizens of a assisted living center, two groups of people who often feel alienated from where we are, who feel the victims of too much surveillance and too much kind of enforced cheer. And that's when I started the book, and even that was quite a few years ago too. But the book kind of stalled out. I had to put it aside. Because to think about an old man deciding to become a pirate captain, I had to imagine what sort of old man would do that. Then it occurred to me that if the older man had Alzheimer's, if he had dementia, another form of escape from ordinary life, if he was losing his mind, that maybe that would be something that would happen. But I didn't know anything about dementia. I didn't have anyone in my life with dementia, and I only had the kind of shallowest media portrayals of dementia, which I was knowledgeable enough to knew were unfair, but didn't really know anything about it. And I didn't know how to tackle that problem. I thought, well, am I going to volunteer at some center and be wildly taking notes on the side? That felt kind of unsavory and exploitative. So I put the book away, and in the intervening years, my father received a diagnosis. And then suddenly, this thing that was quite distant from me, I was quite intimate with, and I had kind of a front row seat in the experience of having that happen. And it was then that I felt like I could find the emotional center to write about someone with that when I had seen that happen. And so then I was able to take up the book again, and just as my father passed, to finish the book and to feel like I got to keep him alive and present, as it were, by putting some of his behaviors and some of what I've noticed in this book.
Well, I noticed that your very first novel, The Basic Eight, is a dark look at a teenage girl, and you've often dealt with teenagers in Lemony Snicket books. They seem to run throughout your career, and what you look at is the dark side of being 14.
That's what I remember, and that's what strikes me. And I now meet many young, well, men and women in particular, and that kind of adolescent energy and that kind of adolescent anger I find inherently interesting. It seems to me, when I'm thinking about a story, if you make the central character a 14-year-old girl or a teenager, suddenly everything is interesting. Suddenly everything is more fraught, and that to me is interesting.
You also have a secondary lead character, her father, Phil Needle, who is a radio guy. How did that subplot come into the story of the pirates? Where did that come from?
I worked in radio for a little while. One of my first writing jobs was that I was writing radio scripts. The idea of radio, which anyone can hear, which is broadcast kind of invisibly, seemed like a very powerful idea to me when we're talking about people who want to escape, who want to get out of range.
Daniel Handler, the book itself, the cover makes it look like a young adult novel. I mean, when you think about this, and you're thinking about teenagers, you are thinking young adult, yet the story itself and the elements in it are definitely pretty dark.
Well, I've never really understood what young adult literature is. Children's literature to me seems like a nice, firm genre. I know what that is. I can draw a line from Where the Wild Things Are through The Bluest Eye and Charlotte's Web. I know what that inhabits. With young adult, it seems more like a marketing ploy. A lot of young adult literature seems like 17 magazine. You read it when you're 14 and you read it when you're 23, but you do not read it when you're 17. I think We Are Pirates has a young teenage girl as a heroine. People who are interested in reading about that will be interested in reading it. I'm sure some teenagers will pick it up. I mean, I'm not a marketing expert, and I don't sit around when I'm writing a book thinking, you know, what niche shall we reach today?
Pirates, in many ways, run through the book even when you're not talking about pirates. How much reading did you do pirate literature? Because at various times you list a whole bunch of books, and I've only read one book, Captain Blood, but I've seen a lot of pirate movies.
I read a ton. As soon as I started this book, I really got interested in pirate, not only the literature, not only the kind of classic novels of piracy, but some studies of it as well. I think I'm the kind of writer for whom the line between research and enthusiasm is pretty thin. If I get interested in something, then I'm reading it. And I take delight in reminding myself, oh, this counts as work. I'm sitting around all afternoon at Cafe Flora reading pirate novels. This counts as working, but it doesn't have the texture of research. But what I really got interested in were the kind of histories of piracy and to realize what a powerful idea that is. One of the big inspirations for the book was reading that pirates and map makers were often in cahoots. So if you were an innocent sailor, you could purchase a map, and the map said, look, there's a shortcut here, there's a waterway this way, and then if you took it, it was actually an ambush. And that felt like a very powerful idea to me, to think about the world at a time when you really had to rely on a map. Nowadays, you can't give anybody a false map. You couldn't have tricked me to come a different way to this,
right,
to the radio. I'm in an automobile, everyone has a screen in their pocket that will tell them how to get to Algeria in 12 steps if they need to. That was a very poignant idea to me. And there's a kind of classic study of piracy called The Wooden World, which postulates the idea that once you step off board and onto a ship, you can really be in a world of your own creation. Many people who felt and were outcasts in society ended up in piracy for various reasons, not only for the kind of bloodthirstiness and the theft, but also for the idea that your identity could be fluid. So there's actually a lot of early transsexuality and transvesticism. Piracy was very attractive for people of mixed racial characteristics in societies where there was no place for them there. And that just got really interesting to me, the idea that you could step off the world, and that I think now in the current day feels so impossible. You don't have the sense that you can go off and do your own thing and you'll be utterly unreachable. There's no such thing as going off the map. You know, people used to be able to take a walk around the block and have their phone ring unanswered. And nowadays, of course, you'll have your phone with you. And if your phone's in your pocket, someone may be able to trace where you are. We live in a world of almost constant surveillance, much of it supposedly friendly, most of it from family members and things like that. That was something I began to think of, and then when I began to think about it, I saw it everywhere. I met a bunch of teenagers in my Snicket tours when cell phones were first being given to young people who were upset about it, who realized that no longer could they call their parents and say they were one place when they were really another, which is a very powerful freedom. And similarly, people I met who were going into assisted living centers suddenly found that the biggest shock was that no longer could they be someplace where nobody knew where they were. Even the smallest errand, even the tiniest journey, you were watched over, sometimes electronically and sometimes personally. That's where my pirate research led me, was into these kind of ideas. So it started with the trappings of the literature of pirates and parrots and eye patches, but it led to this notion of getting away from the world and wondering if that's still possible. The Snicket series that I'm just finishing up now, which is called All the Wrong Questions, takes place in the world of noir literature. There's so many detectives who say, so I left a couple of messages or I put an ad in the paper, and then I sat all day playing solitaire at my desk, waiting for the call back, you know, waiting for the blackmailer to get back to me, waiting for the woman to call about the sum of money. That's such a strange idea now to think I'd have to sit at my desk all day long in case that person calls back.
Daniel Handler, about three quarters of the way through the book, there's a change of tone, and I don't want to give away what it is, but things turn very, very dark, a lot darker than they appear early on when the book is kind of a comedy. And the question is, was that always there?
I think it was. I mean, I was interested in the idea of what happens when you try to leave the world and become a pirate, and the people who have this idea, whether because of dementia or kind of youthful rebellion, don't really think out what's going to happen. They're into the stealing of the boat, they're into the gathering of the materials, but once they really hit the water, it's as if they haven't given a thought about what it really is to board other people's boats and take them, or what the violence is that comes with that. And I wanted the book similarly to take a kind of sudden and dark turn. A lot of pirate literature has trouble juggling that, and so some of the literature, particularly the kind of cheap genric stuff, it's either violent and dark all the way through, or it's giddy all the way through, and I was interested in combining them. I ended up reading a lot of Latin American literature, which, to speak in broad general terms anyway, often balances out. You can have great happiness and sudden violence, how you can have great sadness and also kind of slapstick comedy. And that was a literature, too, that runs through this book that helped me make those decisions and make the book go the way I wanted.
Lemony Snicket for a kid's book is those books can get very dark, too.
Similarly, those books have that balance. I mean, the Snicket books are full of things that make children laugh. They're also full of terrible things that happen to children. And I always think the younger you are, the more in tune you are with that. If you're a 1.5-year-old, 30% of your day you're crying. If that were happening right to an adult, it would be the worst day you ever had. For a kid, that's completely average. I can't open the wrapper that contains the cookie. Someone stepped on my toe. I dropped something and it made a noise. All those things will make you cry, and yet it isn't really that you're having a bad day when you're that age. Also, you're laughing. Also, you're full of joy. And the Snicket books walk that line, and I think We Are Pirates occupies a kind of similar ambiguous territory.
Are you ever afraid you're going to cross the line? I mean, how do you try to maintain that balance in both children's books and in books like We Are Pirates? Or is that something you don't worry about?
I don't think of it as a line, I guess. I think of it as a story, and a story that I think would be interesting. I have a friend who runs a literary magazine, and I asked him once how he manages to sort through the thousands of stories that he receives. And he says what he looks for is a consistent rate of surprise, that a surprising sentence, a surprising paragraph, a surprising turn of plot, the notion that you might end up someplace where you don't know where you are at the beginning. And I really liked that idea. If there's a line I try to walk, that's the line I walk, is to a story that doesn't feel schizophrenic, but feels like it contains multitudes.
Is that the reason why you withheld a very important piece of information until the final pages?
There's nothing like a surprise ending.
Though, of course, you know, when you're creating the right surprise ending, if you think about it, it always makes sense. It should make sense from the beginning.
I think that's what makes for a powerful surprise ending. The surprise ending can't be, I'm writing a story about three generations of a family who live in a beach house, and then at the end they're all eaten by bears. That's not a good surprise ending. You want a surprise ending that thinks, I knew there was something, I was grasping at something. I've heard a mystery writer speak recently, and she talked about writing a solution to a murder mystery that makes you feel like if you'd had five more minutes, you would have reached that solution yourself, that you think, oh, I knew there was something there, and even though the reader is actually quite far from knowing, even though as the mystery writer, you've denied them facts that would help them see this, that they have the sense of about to discover it. And for me, that's what makes it interesting.
And working that through, going back, creating the book so that that thing would be that kind of surprise, did you take anything out, put anything extra in?
Mostly take things out. I'm mostly a writer whose first drafts are hundreds and hundreds of pages, and then I'm taking them away. I find it easier to take out than to put in. Every so often when I have to add something in a book, it feels like the end of the world, where I think, oh, I do need a scene here, and I feel like I have to tear all the wires out of this great machine, whereas cutting things out just feels like a trim.
I guess it happens with the children's books as well. They say that sometimes characters take over and become more important and almost right themselves. And I don't want to get into the philosophy behind that, but
right.
did that happen in We Are Pirates? And also, did that happen in a series of unfortunate events?
I'm imagining them, and so they're looming large in my head. And, you know, sometimes when writing a series of unfortunate events, I'd meet friends for drinks or something, and they would say, "You seem a little sad." And I would say, "Well, it's, you know, I've been writing about children getting thrown down an elevator shaft all day." So in that way, they would loom in my head. But I've always been nervous when writers say, "Oh, the character talks to me," or "He led me places I didn't want to go," or all these things. That's not how I feel at all. I like to quote Muriel Spark, who said her relationship to her own characters was like that of a cat to birds.
But you're also allowing your unconscious to make decisions, aren't you?
I guess so. I mean, as the old joke says, if I had an unconscious, I'd know about it. There's definitely a sense that your brain is operating on planes that you're not always consciously aware of, and you try to let that happen a little bit. But I don't feel it in the voices of my characters. I just feel that as kind of a general process. I mean, I feel it about things outside my writing life that I think, oh, my subconscious was working on that all along.
Do you ever get into the idea that on some level these are real people in an alternate dimension? I mean, does that happen?
I do not. I think when people have said to me that about the characters, oh, I feel so close to these characters, or I really am by that character, I'm very pleased because it means it's living in their head in some way. But I don't really consider that another dimension, though I guess if everyone's imagination is a different dimension, then sure.
You're listening to an interview with Daniel Handler, whose latest book is titled We Are Pirates. Another book coming out around the same time, but I don't have it here, is Hurry Up and Wait. What is that?
Hurry Up and Wait is another one of my collaborations with Myra Kelman, an artist who I admire very much and who I cynically cultivated a friendship with so that we might work together. She and I did a picture book together called 13 Words, and we did a novel together. I wrote the novel, and she illustrated it, called Why We Broke Up. And then she showed me this collection she had of photographs of girls standing on lawns that she'd just gotten from thrift stores and things like that, and that it was one of those things that one photograph struck her, and then before she knew it, it was everywhere. If you have a new dress, if you're going to a wedding or a party, that you might stop on your way out and have your photograph taken in front of your house. And there were such interesting photographs really stretching across the way that we wanted to do a book of them together. So I wrote some text and she painted some of the photographs. We had some of the originals in there. And we were bringing the idea to the Modern Museum of Art in New York. And the Modern Museum said, you know, we like that, but we would really like it if you were interacting with the photographs that we already own. And so Myra said, that's so funny, I would like to donate these photographs to the MoMA. That was Girls Standing on Lawns, and now we just have another one coming out, which is called Hurry Up and Wait. We couldn't pull the same trick twice, so we looked at the photographic archives of the MoMA, which was a fantastic thing to do, and found photographs of people hurrying up and waiting. So it's a small book about that notion of movement, about when you're in a hurry and when you're waiting, and those captured moments, some of them look really quick and some of them look really slow.
Daniel Handler, let's go back and talk a little bit about your pseudonym, Lemony Snicket. Somebody said, or maybe you said, that this kind of a relationship with Jiminy Cricket, or did that come after the fact?
Well, people have pointed out that Lemony Snicket sounds a little like Jiminy Cricket, and I like the idea that I would be tweaking that kind of moralistic insect who is so irritating to Pinocchio. But no, the name came actually while I was on the phone with a right-wing political organization when I was researching my first novel, The Basic Eight, which makes fun of certain right-wing narratives. I was on the phone with an organization, and they asked me for my name so they could mail me their materials, which I was hungry to receive so I could mock them. And I thought, oh, don't say your real name. And so that's what came out of my mouth when they asked me for my name.
And so when you began to write a series of unfortunate events, how did The Bad Beginning was the first book. How did the name Lemony Snicket suddenly attach itself to that?
I began to think about the mysterious world that a series of unfortunate events was inhabiting, and that the story of the Baudelaire orphans and a series of unfortunate events is narrated by this man, Lemony Snicket, or narrated by a man who was then unnamed. And I just thought it would be really interesting to publish the books under the name of the narrator rather than under the name of the author. So it sounds a little academic, but I've never really thought of it as a pseudonym or as a pen name. It's more that it's published under the name of the narrator. You know, if Nabokov has published Lolita as written by Humbert Humbert or something like that, that's what it felt like to be. And then I had this name, Gathering Dust, from pranking right-wing organizations. So I thought, why not tidy that up?
was the idea of making Lemony Snicket the back of your head or your hands or whatever and kind of create this alternative universe human being. Was that idea from the publisher? Did that come from you?
No, that idea was from me. I wanted these books to be as mysterious as possible. I thought they were going to be failures. So really what I pictured was that 20 years from now, someone would find one in an old bookshop and say, what in the world is this? So I liked that idea. When the publisher was about to send me on tour, they were asking the very sensible question, well, you've created this mysterious author, and what are you going to do when you show up? And so I began to say that Lemony Snicket couldn't be there, and that I had to be here in his place as his kind of bumbling representative. I liked that idea a lot because I felt it wasn't a lie, it was true. Lemony Snicket could not be there, being as he is the narrator of entirely fictional universes.
Did you realize that it would be multiple volumes when you wrote The Bad Beginnings?
It was definitely in my head. The publisher made it clear that that would not necessarily be the case. But I thought the only thing more interesting than terrible things happening to children is 13 books of terrible things happening to children. So I immediately said, oh, it should be 13 volumes. And the publisher said, in effect, let's just see how we do, Mr. Handler.
And it took off.
It did. It failed to fail, I guess. I really thought that they were so miserable, and I knew perhaps a small slice of children would like them, but I also thought that children's literature has some quite conservative and staid guardians of that. You know, children are a readership that you usually don't reach directly. You're reaching through educators and librarians and parents. I just thought they're not going to like this sort of thing, and to my delight, they did. And it's been an enormous surprise. I'm still kind of not over it that so many people got interested in a series of unfortunate events.
When I talked to Philip Pullman, and he, you know, his series was publicized as young adult, and it's basically an ode to atheism, and people didn't get it. And this is very, very dark, evil stuff happens to these kids, and the kids love it.
Yeah. When you're a child, I mean, some of the first texts you encounter are about terrible things happening. You know, one of the first things you're going to mutter to a child is about three blind mice having their tails cut off with a carving knife. And I think when you're a child and the world is so enormous and so shocking all the time, you're used to that kind of melodrama. So I've experienced very few children who are not interested in these books, but every so often the adults say, I can't imagine my child would like this. And then I think, just wait.
The character of Lemony Snicket, the biography grew and grew and grew. I guess you just suddenly kept throwing stuff out. Do you worry about consistency, or is Lemony Snicket such an unreliable narrator?
Well, both. He's an unreliable narrator, and there's consistency. When I was finishing a series of unfortunate events, one of the most difficult things was to go back and reread books that I'd finished a few years ago, which is quite painful. You know, it's really, for me, like looking through an old yearbook and looking at what your hairdo used to be. But I wanted those to be consistent. And Netflix, the television company, is working on an adaptation of all 13 volumes of a series of unfortunate events. And so I've been forced once again to go back into the breach and to look at these things and to figure out how all those storylines put together, and it's quite exhausting.
What about the unauthorized autobiography?
Or as I like to call it, WGC Bald, but for kids. I got interested in WGC Bald, this European writer who writes these quite mysterious books. He died a few years ago, sadly, just when everyone thought he was going to win the Nobel Prize. And about halfway through the series, people were asking so many questions about Lemony Snicket that my publisher said it would be really great to release some kind of handbook or some kind of book. And I thought, well, I don't want to explain those things. But some book that increased the mystery, that frustrated all people with the questions, that seemed like fun to me. So I took the most mysterious author I knew, W.G. Sebald, and I began to gather photographs of my own and to concoct a book that's, you know, so experimental and so ridiculous, and yet continues to find 11-year-old readers who approach me with the book full of post-its and notations and everything as they're trying to grapple with this impossibility.
Do you think that what you're doing is basically tapping into something about kids that no one else seems to tap into?
Well, I think plenty of people tap into it, but I mean, I think it's the essential mystery of life. The journey of a series of unfortunate events is the journey of childhood. You are cast into a world of which you know nothing. You cannot trust the people who are saying that they ought to be in charge of your life. And you are slowly trying to find your own path, your own life path, your own moral path in a very confusing and perplexing and often monstrous world. I think all good children's literature touches that. I think a story about a pig who's constantly in danger of being slaughtered, but if the spider writes the right thing in the web, it can be rescued. I think the idea of, thanks to my evil stepmother, I'm wandering around the forest and the only person who seems like they have an interest in me has a house full of candy and a hungry gleam in her eye. This is all grappling with the world. So I think there are many authors who do it. And for me, for children's literature, the people who do it best are those who are tapping into this dark mystery that is planet Earth.
And they're not talking down to the kids either.
People sometimes say, why do you insist on teaching children that terrible things are in the world? And I think, I'm not teaching them. They know, any child who has seen the slightest schoolyard injustice, who has seen the slightest amount of pain that happens if you move your body the wrong way when you're learning how to walk, they know that the world is full of terrible things. And a story that acknowledges it is important. And a story that says, don't be silly, as long as you behave well, everything's going to be fine, is not encouraging.
The story of the happy childhood, I mean, we hear about it, but I don't know anybody who will say, oh, I had a totally happy childhood, or even worse, I had a totally happy adolescence.
When you're an adult, you think to yourself, I wish I had no mortgage and that someone would buy me an ice cream cone every Saturday. And then you think, oh, I had that in childhood. I must have had a happy childhood. But if you ask the average 7-year-old, did you have a good day, they're going to say, eh.
When you're 7 years old and an hour is a day, you know, in the life like an adult's, and you're sitting there in second grade, how could you possibly be happy?
The imagination and what is being denied you, and not just by people who are being cruel, but just the kind of what you're being denied in terms of what might happen in your head and what people can actually provide for you. That's a very wide gap, and it's very heartbreaking. When my son was very little, we had a free day once on a weekend, and I said, what would you like to do? We could do anything. And he said, I would like to be an apprentice for a spy. You know, and I had to kind of walk that down from we can do anything to, you know, what I meant was we could go to the beach and then go to an Italian restaurant, which is, of course, nowhere near as fun as apprenticing yourself to a spy. If you are an imaginative child, which every child is, and you think to yourself, tomorrow I'd like to be an Egyptian mummy, or, you know, I'd like to have flowers be able to grow when I snap my fingers, just to learn that that's not possible, then you're already having a miserable childhood through nobody's fault.
So you said that that this is becoming a Netflix original series. How happy were you with the film with Meryl Streep?
Well, I have a strict policy not to say mean things about any film that bought me a house. It's the same with people. So if you'd like to buy me a house, I'll say, I don't care what you say about Mr. Wilinski, I like that guy. But it was a 5-year experience. I worked on the movie for 5 years, and then I was fired. It was full of ups and downs. I'm mostly curious about how other people liked it, and certainly it spread news of the books. And shortly before his first election, I met then not yet President Obama, and he said to me, oh, my daughter saw that movie, and they got interested in those books. And, you know, that hasn't happened with Watch Your Mouth or with Girls Standing on Lawns or other books that I've done. The power of Hollywood is quite intense. And the books, I think, benefited from that experience, even if the movie itself is unlikely to go next to Citizen Kane in the history of American film.
Or create a sequel, even though it was a success. But this Netflix original series, how involved are you?
Well, right now, quite involved. I'm sure they'll get tired of that soon enough. You know, we're all trying to work together well, but entertainment companies who are in charge of the money, the enormous amounts of money that must be spent to make something like that, are trying to make the best decisions they can. I am not a writer who's terribly embittered by the Hollywood process, I think maybe because I don't expect that much. So if the people seem nice and they're actually asking me questions about the books, then we're already halfway to a joyous experience.
Daniel Handler, you're a political progressive. Do you slip any politics in your books at all? Do you avoid it? How does that work?
My literary agent, Charlotte Sheedy, an inspirational person, always says that all books are political because it's either about the status quo or it's against the status quo. I like to think a series of unfortunate events is about the experience of greed for money creating wrecks of families and about the disenfranchised in the world. As far as books go about the plight of the disenfranchised, I don't think The Bad Beginning is likely to make the top 10 or anything. But I think there's political overtones and a critique and a sense of looking askance at the world in all of what I do, and that's what I consider. You know, I don't think of political progressivism as supporting a list of candidates or making sure you sign the petition. I think it's a way of looking at the world, of thinking this world is broken and we would like to move forward and we would like to go somewhere where we're in a better place.
Daniel Handler, at the National Book Awards, you made some comments which were intended to be funny but weren't. So let me ask you, you apologized for it, you gave money. But the nature of humor, how do you deal with drawing a line? Is there a line? Obviously, on some level, you cross the line.
The only thing that really wrangles me from my point of view about it is when it was taken to be a joke. I wasn't really, as you say, trying to be funny. I was actually trying to tell a story. I told a story about my friend, Jacqueline Woodson, who won the prize, and a conversation that she and I had when I served her gazpacho and how that conversation led. And I told it very badly, which I will certainly own, and was very pained and very apologetic to have caused so much distress in a community that's important to me. The story that I told was about exploring these kinds of issues and about the kind of powerful literature that Jackie makes in those books, and particularly for young people. And so for me, it's part of that conversation about progressive politics and about making the world a better place. The narratives in Jackie Woodson's work are so essential, I think, particularly for young people, because so much young people's literature about racial relations in America tells a story where a long time ago there were some bad people who we do not resemble in any way, who did some terrible things, and thank goodness that's over. And even if we were in that time, all of us would have stood exactly in the right place and said exactly the same, the right things. And that's a really noxious moral to teach young people, because the story of race in America is not over, as anybody knows. So what I tried to do at the National Book Awards was tell a story that called attention and paid tribute to what she was doing. Came out very badly. I feel intensely apologetic about how crappily it came out. It was an attempt to be a joke, though. It was an attempt to continue this conversation, which I think is pretty essential.
You know, from what I've read of it, people completely missed that point, that it wasn't intended as a joke.
I think I told it very badly. I won't excuse my own activities. I'm sure some people were less than generous in their assessment of it. But, I mean, I think some people were rightfully upset. But I think we're in a good place now. I was grateful that the community could come together, and I did a matching donation program. So, as you said, it wasn't just that I was kind of donating money, but everybody was. And we raised about $200,000 for We Need Diverse Books, which is an organization on which Jackie is the board, then moves forward in publishing and tries to make those changes different. That was, for me, an important distinction, that there's a conversation to be had about literature and there's a conversation to be had about publishing, which is a whole different kind of world and requires a set of changes that are very specific.
But it also brings up questions concerning the nature of humor and drawing a line or figuring out a line between what's funny because it's a little over the top and what goes toward the offensive. And as a writer who often writes humor, how do you view that? Do you worry about those things?
Well, I think it's complicated. I think it's an interesting conversation. You know, and there's plenty of sentences in the world which some people will find hilarious and some people will find not funny, and then some people will be offended by. And then there's people who will have at least two of those reactions at once, that you could find it hilarious and be offended, that you can think it's not funny, but hilarious. To me, it's just the complication of the human experience. So it was not fun to be in the middle of a maelstrom about it. When I managed to get a hold of Jackie the next day, and I was talking to people who were really close to me about it, then I was kind of less devastated about what had happened and more interested in what kind of discussion could be brought to fruition. So if the wrong remark sparks a conversation that moves everybody forward, how could that be a bad thing?
Daniel Handler, on your Wikipedia it says Why We Broke Up is being turned into a movie, and yet it doesn't exist on IMDb.
It was in development for a while as a movie, and I guess it's still technically in development, and it appears to have stalled out the way most Hollywood adaptations do.
And The Composer is Dead is a piece that the San Francisco Symphony performed that introduces children to musical instruments. How did that come about?
It came about when I was asked to narrate a performance of Peter and the Wolf. And the music of Peter and the Wolf, Prokofiev, is quite beautiful, but the story is really kind of inane. And it doesn't do a very good job, the story, of introducing those instruments. And that sparked an idea, and I ended up collaborating with the Bay Area's own local composer, Nathaniel Stuckey. And he and I wrote this piece, The Composer is Dead, that is, I like to say, is combines the notion of Peter and the Wolf with a good episode of Law and Order. So the composer is, in fact, dead, and each section of the orchestra is questioned about their role in the crime. The piece has been performed all over the world. For many years, it was the most performed piece of new music, which is quite a hilarious position to be in. It's like being the world's tallest midget. But the piece has been performed all over the place. It was turned into a book. It was adapted for the stage, not just a few blocks from here at Berkeley Rep. It's where it was performed for a while. So that was a lot of fun to collaborate that way.
Daniel Handler, now you've got We Are Pirates. You have Hurry Up and Wait. What else have you got? You said that there's the final book of All the Wrong Questions.
In the fall, we'll bring the fourth and final volume in All the Wrong Questions. Each volume is a question, and that's a series that chronicles Lemony Snicket's own adolescence, his own apprenticeship in a secret organization. It's kind of similar to what you were asking about the autobiography, that many people were starting to ask me, what happened before a series of unfortunate events? And they meant right before, but I turned the clock back hopelessly long before. So the series appears to be mystifying and frustrating readers wherever I go, which is my way.
You intend beyond this to keep up with Lemony?
Yes, I'm sure Mr. Snicket and I will continue to correspond. I think I will always be writing for young people and always be writing for adults as well. They're both really interesting to me, and they feel like part of the same conversation. I've heard a rumor that some children even become adults.
You've been listening to an interview with Daniel Handler, whose latest book is We Are Pirates, a novel, also Hurry Up and Wait. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.